that. I think he might. First of all, can I, before I go on, where's Jan? Jan, put your hand up, please. Where are you? Not here? Where is she? What court? Oh, there she is. Jan. First of all, I just want to thank... no, I know you don't want to, but I just want to thank the Jan and the office staff, including Nikki Ross, for the organising of this. You know, it's always organised without any fuss. It's very seamless. I know it's going to be good. How easy is it for me? You know, I didn't have to come down here early and, you know, set up tables and, you know, get the kitchen and so on. Lucky me. So thank you very much, Jan. Thank you. So, and now I want to thank everyone that's come here. Thank you very much for coming. Now you're thinking, well, that's not such a big deal. Yes, it is. Yes, it is. To get people to actually come and to be involved and to participate in community events is not an easy thing. And as you would know, any of you that are, you know, involved in the organising of communal things. And the fact that you've come... The fact that you've come means that you've put up your hand and you've said, I want to be involved. And really, that's what a community is. That's what a community is. We have a community. So here is a very nice part of the women's community of Perth and of the PHC more particularly. So thank you very much for coming along and being part of the community. Rabbi Grunstein, what can I say to you? Words
actually. Well, love to be able to say anything.
No, I want to say something. Now, Rabbi Grunstein has been here before. He does persist in coming back, so we must be doing something right. So, thank you very much, Rabbi Grunstein. Rabbi Grunstein has been here only since Thursday. He's had such an action packed program, I don't know how really you can keep your eyes open, to be honest, because he's been so busy, so busy. But always, you know, in such good humour, you've given us such inspiration. You've enlivened us, you've revved us up, and here you are. So hopefully, it's been good for you and you've enjoyed it. You've certainly given us a wonderful Shabbos and beyond. Now, Rabbi Grunstein's talking about, I don't know exactly what Rabbi Grunstein's talking about. I had a look at the title, and he's talking about Orthodox women, opportunities, I saw, evolutions and revolutions, which I really like. You know, it's an exciting time, and I don't know what Rabbi Grunstein is going to talk about, but, you know, the position of Orthodox women has never been static in history. We might, Rabbi Grunstein may talk about this. We've been moving along a bit of an evolutionary, at times revolutionary line, which has really been good, and, I remember thinking that every time women complain, and maybe Robert Wilson might expound on this, every time women complained about unfairness and injustice, they actually got what they want. Would you agree with that? Am I overstating that? Maybe. They did get a lot of what they wanted. They honestly did. I know you're thinking, what is she talking about? No, but there is some truth in that, definitely. And, I mean, that might be the subject of another lecture. Anyway, Rabbi Grunstein, delighted to welcome you here to this podium. And we have some source sheets. Should we give those out now?
Yes.
Okay, going to give those out. Okay, please come up. Thank you.
Before you sit down, thank you so much for those beautiful words and for the beautiful Shabbos and for the beautiful, and I would say, privilege to come back to PHC. So I brought you something very small from Israel. By a relative of mine, I gave one to your husband, and I'd like to give this to you. It's a pad, of course, but it says in it "Baha'aracha," which means with appreciation.
So, a good morning to everyone. It's really a pleasure to be back at the Women's Breakfast at PHC, as I believe we did exactly 3 years ago in this room, not on this topic. Because things have changed and evolved since that time in a way that has been, in my opinion, unprecedented in the history of Jewish women in the last 3 years. And I'll try to explain what I mean by trying to bring you back to an issue that happened not so long ago. When I was a kid, and that's about, I won't say, But the lack of my hair, you can probably see that I wasn't a kid yesterday. One of the most important movies that we were forced to watch was Mary Poppins. And Mary Poppins, as you all know, is a wonderful film. Has many, many different aspects to it. Amongst them is the famous song, Votes for Women and the Right for Women to Vote. You all know that was a big issue in the UK at the turn of the last century. And as we say in Jewish, anything that happens in the non-Jewish world eventually spills over to the Jewish world. And if you look in the top of your source sheet, you'll see a responsum by the Sephardic chief rabbi of Israel of then, Rav Uziel, dealing with the issue. And this is the way he writes about it, and I'm reading now in the English. Women's rights in elections and public management and settlement. There were two issues. The first issue is, can a woman actually vote? And number two, can she occupy a position of leadership within the political system? In other words, can she be Golda Meir, the Prime Minister of Israel? This is at the turn of the 20th century. Rav Uziel is dealing with the issue, and this is what he says. This question was a bone of contention in Israel and rocked the entire land of Israel. And leaflets and warnings, brochures and articles published in newspapers frequently prohibit the prohibition of participation of women in elections altogether. These relied on the words of the Torah law. And those maintaining the moral fence of modesty. And those of peace. And those of peace in the family. And he goes on and on to talk about which issue? The issue of elections, women's right to vote in the elections. And everything he says is true. It's documented that that was a major issue at the turn of the last century. We are now in the year 2016. Women, thank God, not only vote, but the rabbis force them to vote because they want to get more seats for their parties. And therefore, this is no longer an issue. What stayed the same is that we have new issues today that have to do with the place of a woman in leadership roles within the Orthodox community. And everything Rav Uziel writes here is correct today. It's not rocking just the entire land of Israel. It's rocking the entire Jewish world. If you don't believe me, and don't believe anything I say, go home, open up your computer to any search engine, put in women, orthodoxy, and you will find endless, endless articles in the last 2 years on this issue, ranging from yay to nay to in between. And indeed, this is on the agenda today of almost every Orthodox synagogue that I visited around the world. And this is on the agenda of orthodoxy today, as I see it. What I'm going to try to do today is to present the issue as fair as I can to you. And I hope that when you leave here today, you'll have an appreciation of the heading that Aviva so beautifully presented. Opportunities, evolutions, and revolutions. Because all the above are happening. Not to mention the fact that while it's happening, there are obviously people that say nothing should change and everything is perfect the way it is. This particular lecture of the 9 I've already given, I think is going to be the most controversial. Because it's going to be controversial, I don't want you to leave here and say this is what we have to think, but I want you to say this is what people are thinking about. And I'd like to hear your thoughts as well as my own. I don't like only listening to myself. Maybe some of you like talking to yourself. I don't. And therefore, I see this as a learning session. So please feel free at any point to raise your hand, to comment, to disagree, to agree, and do what you can. Yes? Both. Absolutely both. Now, let's put on the table the obvious. The role of women in Jewish life has changed. If you can think about your grandmothers and your great-grandmothers, some of them didn't even ever come to shul, perhaps on Rosh Hashanah to hear shofar. That has changed tremendously. Women are now literate, they can read. Not only are they literate, but it's taken for granted today. One of the issues that rocked the Jewish world, can women learn Torah? There is not a Hasidic sect out there to the most modern Orthodox left-wing sect that does not teach Torah to women. You have a school here in Perth called Carmel. I didn't check, but I am absolutely certain that women are learning Torah as well as men. You should know that was a major issue at one point. It's no longer an issue today. The issue today, as I see it, is the place of women in leadership roles within the synagogue and within Jewish life in general. There are women presidents already of synagogues. That's a point of contention, but it happens, and it is out there. There is already women that are very knowledgeable, that can teach a shir in Gemara, give a lecture on the Talmud at the highest level as well as a man can. But today in 2016, I believe that the issue that's rocking the Jewish world is not elections for women, that's already a done deal, but rather, can women play a leadership role in a synagogue? And I don't mean president or board member, even though some synagogues opt not to do that. I think that in general, it's already becoming more and more accepted. But I'm talking about something else. And that is, can a woman actually be a poseket halakha, decide Jewish law just like a man? You come to a woman and you say, Rabbi, my dairy spoon touched meat. What should I do? Instead of going to the rabbi, you go to a woman that's knowledgeable and she'll be the one to tell you the answer. Number two, can you call a woman a rabbi? In the Orthodox world, can she be a rabbi of a synagogue? Number three, if you don't want to go that far, perhaps she should be and can be on the rabbinic staff or the clergy of the synagogue. So you have a synagogue with a rabbi, let's say a male, and you have a president, and you have a youth director, and you also have a woman clergy with the name that you choose. And the name is going to be very important, as you're about to see. I want to bring as much information to you as I can. So the first few sources I'm not going to read out loud, but I want to tell you how this issue is playing out today. And I'm taking the United States and Israel as an example, but you can go to the UK, and you can go to other places. The same issue is happening everywhere. And here is the story. There are four basic points of view out there today as to the question of, can women have leadership roles in synagogue? From leading services, parts of the services, to being the rabbi of the synagogue. How did the Jewish world, or does the Jewish world, react? What do you think? Without looking at the sheets, when I tell you, we're going to change the framework of the synagogue, what is the immediate reaction? No. So Aviva, excuse me for disagreeing, but when you said before, when a woman demanded something, she got it, you forgot one little middle step, and that is that the first reaction of a man is no. The first reaction of the community is no. The first reaction of any community to any change, nothing to do with women or men or women, any change, changing the services, changing the length of the services, changing a tune in the services, the first reaction always is negative. This goes back to the day we left the ghetto way back when. Moses Mendelssohn left the ghetto way back when. All of a sudden there was an enlightenment, there was a reform movement and a conservative movement, and the general feeling is any time you want to change something, you're about to ruin the tradition of generations, and the initial answer is always no. Just like we tell our kids when they ask for something, our initial reaction is no, so too in the synagogue. When someone asks for something, their initial reaction is not, let's consider it, let's think about it, let's give it some thought, let's drink a lot of water and go to sleep on it, but rather the first reaction is no. Then, as time goes on, it evolves. And today, what I'd like to do is to show you how an issue that is now on the agenda is being responded to by various groups within the Orthodox world. And the issue is, can a woman be a clergy on the clerical staff of the synagogue? The first reaction on page number one, where it says number one, is of Agudas Yisrael. Agudas Yisrael was founded in 1920-something. It is 1919, to be precise. It is what's usually colloquially called the ultra-Orthodox movement. They have a faction in the Israeli Knesset. They have, all over the world, they have various different branches. And they're basically what we usually call the Black Hatters. Let's just give that name. They basically said that anything that has to do with what's called in America open orthodoxy, allowing women to paskin shilos, namely decide Jewish law, allowing women to be rabbis of synagogues, allowing women to even give a sermon, is absolutely, unequivocally forbidden and not orthodox. Done. They're out of orthodoxy. We've shifted them out. If you go that way, you're out of orthodoxy. You're no longer part of the big tent called orthodox. Gone. And in the back of the source sheet, you can see the leaflet they put out all the way on the back. They put out a pronouncement in which they said open orthodoxy and its leaders and affiliated entities, and they even name names, have shown countless times that they reject the basic tenets of our faith, particularly the authority of the Torah and its sages. Accordingly, they are no different than other dissident movements throughout our history that have rejected these basic tenets. So the fact that this is happening within orthodoxy, the fact that these movements who do train women to become rabbis are actually using Jewish sources to justify what they're doing, makes no difference to our Agudat Yisrael. They are out. They are no longer orthodox. From our perspective, when we speak about the other streams of Judaism, we can put them in as well. That's the first reaction. Our reaction number two came from the RCA. The RCA is the Rabbinical Council of America, modern Orthodox rabbis throughout North America, that this year decided, and you can see the article on the bottom of page one, decided that if you do nominate a clergy to your synagogue that is called a rabbi or something that sounds like a rabbi, you cannot be a member of this rabbinical institution. In other words, if you're a rabbi who's a member of this institution, you have basically signed on that you will not have in your synagogue a woman on the clerical staff of the synagogue. They did not include one kind of woman, and we'll get back to this later, but one job that a woman does today, which I believe is so important and vital, and I don't know how we lived without it for all these years, and that is what's called a yo'etzet halacha, literally an advisor on halacha to matters that have to do with family purity. On that issue, the RCA said, that's okay, because she's only dealing with one issue, and obviously it's a very intimate issue to say the least, and a woman would feel more comfortable to speak to women, and I don't have to tell you that that is the case. But other than that, no way. If you turn the page, the third reaction is of the institute that I currently work for, the Or Torah Stone Institutes. Amongst them has an institute that trains women. Trains women to be what's called poskot halacha, deciders of Jewish law. Headed by Rabbi Riskin, Rabbi Riskin refuses to call these women rabbis. And as you can see in the articles here, quoted from a letter he sent into the RCA after this pronouncement, he basically said, and this is his position, that if you call a woman a rabbi in orthodoxy, that connotes that the woman can do everything a man can do, including anyone? Being a witness, she can't be. That's a done deal. But that's one thing, yes, being a witness. Tefillin might be okay. It's not the end of the world. The Ramah, the Ashkenazic code of Jewish law says not to do it. But others disagree. They think it's like any mitzvah that a woman can volunteer for, such as shaking a lulav and etrog. There's a bigger issue. Pardon? Be part of a minyan. You're getting closer. A woman is not counted as part of a minyan. Again, we're within halacha here. Who said Aliyah? Aliyah. Aliyah, there is a Gemara that said that there a woman can get an Aliyah on Shabbat, but shouldn't. And it's a question, how do you interpret that Gemara? Aliyah, and I'm sorry, I interrupted you. A Brit, being a Mohelet. Okay. Most rabbis are not Mohalim, so they weren't so concerned with that. Ladies and gentlemen, in a small community, somewhere out there, what does the rabbi do amongst his many duties? He lanes, and he davens, he's the chazan. And Rabbi Riskin felt that if we call them rabbi, small communities out there will say, well, the rabbi can do everything. So the rabbi, just like a rabbi, is called upon to lane sometimes, and to daven, meaning to be the chazan, That would be a problem, because he felt that's against Jewish law. A man who's obligated in prayer can fulfill the obligation for other people that are obligated. A woman who's not obligated to daven in a minyan, a woman's obligated to daven, albeit not in a minyan, cannot fulfill that obligation for others. And therefore, Rabbi Riskin's point of view is that he will ordain women in the sense of they will be able to decide Jewish law, but he will not give them the title rabbi because of that concern that people will interpret it that a woman can do everything a man does in the synagogue, which he felt is not correct against halacha. And the fourth point of view comes out of a gentleman in New York, in Riverdale to be precise. His name is Rabbi Avi Weiss. Bottom of page 2, Rabbi Avi Weiss, with his yeshiva Chovevei Torah for men and yeshivat Maharat for women, has already ordained women, calling one a rabbah, which is the feminine for rabbi. He also went ahead and, when vilified for it, said, okay, I won't call her a rabbah, I'll call her a maharat. Madricha hilchatnit ruchanit toranit. I will translate, or attempt to translate that. A leader who's a religious, Torah, and spiritual leader. If I was ever called such beautiful terms, I'd probably cry. So gorgeous. But he doesn't call her a rabbi, but let's say he's one step under it. And he basically says a woman can be on the clerical staff of the synagogue and there's no problem and they know their limits and they won't do what they're not supposed to do. And ultimately, at this very point, as you could see, three out of the four representatives of modern, of the Orthodox world don't agree with what he's doing. Each one in a different way. Agudat Yisrael says he's not Orthodox. RCAA says maybe what he's doing is correct halachically, but we're against it. Rabbi Riskin says, I will agree with him, but not call them rabbis. And he goes ahead and calls them rabbis. And that's basically what's happening today in the Jewish world on the question of Jewish leadership for women within the Orthodox synagogue. Those four points of view. Either it's totally not Orthodox, it may be Orthodox, but we don't want it part of Orthodoxy. Number three is, don't call them rabbi. And number four is, you can even call them rabbi. Yes, please. Yes. Avi Weiss did call her Maharat and would like to call her Rabbah. The only reason he went down and stepped down was because he got vilified. But Maharat does give the name rabbi to women. In other words, when she's called a Maharat, she's hired for a synagogue as a rabbi. And that's what their intention is, as far as I understand it today. Meaning his intention is not that they will be hired for a synagogue to be on the staff, albeit under certain limits, but they'll be the staff. And someone else will lane, someone else will daven, but they'll be the rabbi. With all that entails. So you can call her Maharat, but ultimately, that's a little different than calling her a poseket halacha, because Maharat already gives her a name. It's a feminine name for rabbi, but it's a name. It's a coined term. Yes. That's correct. They take the same examinations as men do for ordination. They take the same exams, but they do not get the title rabbi. They get the title madricha ruchanit, which means spiritual leader, which is different than rabbi. I know sometimes a rabbi is a spiritual leader, but not always. Now, the reason Rabbi Riskin chose that name was because we deal a lot with placing rabbis and educators around the world, amongst them in small communities. And in small communities, they expect the rabbi to do everything, including daven as a chazan and lein. And he was worried that one day a community will come by, who doesn't know any better, and hire a woman and say, okay, if Rabbi Riskin, who's an Orthodox rabbi, put this woman out as a rabbi, then she can do everything. Obviously, we always thought this was part of the conservative and reform movement. We were wrong! We could do it in our shul as well. And Rabbi Riskin was concerned about that. He's not one now to change the framework of the synagogue, and therefore he said he's only calling her madricha ruchanit. Very good question, which we're going to deal with today. Once you have it in your hand, There's a whole nother question is, does the community accept it? In other words, you can be called Madricha Ruchanit. You took the examinations and whatnot. Now what? Who's going to hire you? And that's exactly where I think Orthodoxy is at this point. So it's out there. Women are trained. They're as knowledgeable as I am. Are people going to hire them for those positions? Here and there, the answer has been yes. They have been hired. Efrat, in Efrat, there is a Madricha Ruchanit today who works together with Rabbi Riskin, who mainly women go to and not men, obviously, right? Just by nature. But men have also asked the questions as time went on. In other places, they refuse to hire such people. So that's exactly where we are today. Correct. Correct. She's on the clerical staff of Efrat. She answers halachic questions. She consults mainly women, but also sometimes men. And like everything a rabbi does outside of the actual prayer service. She does not do funerals, as far as I know. But in Israel, the whole funeral thing is a little different, doesn't work the same way. But quite frankly, she would probably on a Shabbat afternoon give a class, just like a rabbi gives a class on a Shabbat afternoon. I'm sorry? We're going to get to that in a few moments. That's going to be the halachic issue of the day. Can she be a dayan or a dayanet in feminine on a beit din? Okay, that's going to be the main issue. So this is where we are today. This is where we are today. I don't have to tell you that depending on the nature of your synagogue, you're going to decide if you want this as part of your synagogue. Just to throw it out there. Have you heard of partnership minions? No one has heard of partnership minions. Wow. So maybe I shouldn't tell you about it. Suffice it to say, you can look it up on the internet afterwards. It's an Orthodox minion with a mechitza down the middle. Men lead the parts of the services that women can't. But any part of the service that even a young boy can lead, a woman leads. And they move the bima back and forth for delaying. Three aliyahs men, three aliyahs women. The seventh aliyah, I guess they raffle off each week. The Haftorah also, 1 week men, 1 week women. Rabbi Riskin himself wrote an article against such things, which is part of why he decided that he wouldn't want to call them rabbi. Others are for it, not many. It's out there. It exists already in England. It exists already in Melbourne. It exists already in the United States for years. And it's been existing in Israel for even longer. On this particular issue is one of those times where actually Israel was ahead of the United States. Usually it's the opposite. Now, in such a place where the mechitza goes back and forth, the bima goes back and forth, obviously they wouldn't have a problem to hire a woman called whatever you want to call her. But in a shul that is what we call a normative Orthodox shul, you already understand, well, how would this woman fill it in to the clerical staff? Will she give a drasha on Shabbat instead of the rabbi? Maybe not such a big deal. Will she give a eulogy at a funeral? Will she go ahead and do other functions that a rabbi does? Again, all within halacha. We're not going outside of a halachic elastic waist here. But each person will come up with a different point of view. And indeed, that's a good example of some place that would probably say this is wonderful. Other synagogues, which are the more classical, traditional synagogues, would say, well, even if they're right, how do we fit in this woman into our staff? Which is the question I think you asked. Yes. Not only. No big deal. It's on a two poles, and it just goes, it's like a sliding pole, back and forth. You can move a bima, you can move tables on Shabbat, that's not a problem. There's many problems, but that happens not to be the problem. The bima is not the problem. Yes. There's a small difference between egalitarian minyans and partnership minyans, but there's a semantic difference between them. It's around the same thing. But sometimes an egalitarian minyan does not regulate itself by halacha. And therefore, they will allow women to lead parts of the services that they halachically cannot, because they're not obligated in. So if you're not obligated in something, you can't fulfill the obligation on behalf of others. That's what the law is. So therefore, that might happen in egalitarian minyan. In a partnership minyan, it won't happen. Okay. So this is where we are today, and this is where Judaism is today. And the question is, how do we deal with it? And I say we. I mean, how are we supposed to think about it? Because I think we should think about it. Women today can do everything outside the synagogue. They can be doctors, they can be lawyers, they can be professors, they can run for office. There's not one position today that's men only. Perhaps, if there is a men's only swimming or gym, they would not allow a woman to be a lifeguard there. But other than that, a woman could do everything. Now just imagine for a woman today that she can do everything and anything until she gets to the synagogue. As soon as she walks into the synagogue, limits, 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 and limits. That is a challenge. And the question is, how do we deal with that challenge? That outside the synagogue, she can do everything. But when you come into the synagogue, all of a sudden, she's limited. Yes?
It comes down to whether you think of it, whether it's a limit or a release. Because a woman doesn't have to die. She's not time-bound herself. So we're actually better off. So why would you want to shut yourself into a situation where you have to die, that you can't obey with a demon, and you must be present?
First of all, make a few things clear. Number one is women have to daven at least once a day.
Yes, but not three.
Number two, you're absolutely correct. They don't have to daven in a minyan three times a day. And number three, if that particular yoke was taken off my shoulders, I would probably be less tired this morning. But quite frankly, I agree with you on that level. But there are women out there that say, well, where we are today, we're not happy with. And that's exactly the point I wanted to make now. I don't think the women that are coming and saying, we want to be part of the leadership of the synagogue, are doing it for ulterior motives. Or at least, I don't know about the motives. I'm not one of those rabbis that say their real motive is to be feminist and to show that they're men. I don't know what the motives are. I really don't, and I'm not one that judges or can look into your heart. God can look into your heart. I'm not God. I think we have to deal with this issue face value. Does Jewish law allow it? And secondly, do we want it? Those are the two questions that we have to deal with. Does Jewish law allow it? And do we want it? Do we want that to be part of the framework and the character of our synagogues? Or don't we? Even if it's allowed. And I agree with you that if women don't ask for it and they don't feel a need for it, that's great. But there are many women out there that feel that something's missing in their life when so much of Jewish life is surrounded around the synagogue. And yet when they get to the synagogue, in a way they're stifled, they can't express themselves as well and as much as men. And they want to get closer to God. They want to have that spiritual experience, and it's Jewish law that's stopping them. And how do we deal with it? So first of all, I think we have to deal with it halachically. And the second issue, which you'll deal with long after I'm gone, is, even if halachically it's okay, do we want it? Is it something that we, as a synagogue, would like to see in our synagogue? Or no, we don't want it in our synagogue. It's not the character that we're interested in. So if you turn the page, the question was asked before, and I'd like to deal with it as much as possible. If I have to be very, very honest with you, and I believe I have to be brutally, brutally honest on this issue, I believe that there's three models of women within our sources. Three role models of women. All the way on the left side of the page, you see a model of a woman that you could probably think of in your mind, older than perhaps you are, or even maybe some people around this table. The Gemara in Masechet Brachot, page 17a, says, greater is the promise made by God to the women than to the men. For it says, rise up, you women that are at ease, and hear my voice, your confident daughters, listen to my word. Rav said to Rav Chia, how do women merit the world to come? By making their children go to synagogue, meaning Jewish school, to learn, and their husbands to the Beit Midrash to learn, and waiting for the husbands till they return home from the Beit Midrash. According to this model, how would you say, what is a Jewish woman? What should she be doing? First of all, she should be a stay-home mom and not go to work. Second of all, her job is to encourage her children to go to school and to learn, to encourage her husband to go to the synagogue and listen to the rabbi's lectures, wait for her husband to come home late at night when he goes to the rabbi's lectures, and that's how she's going to merit the world to come. In this particular aspect, the woman is the facilitator, I would say the crux of, and the centerpiece of the Jewish home, and that's where she belongs. That's the first model. I don't know how many women would look at this today and say, wow, this is a great compliment, I'm going home to do it. But you'd be surprised that many women will feel fulfillment in just this. I don't know any, but I'm assuming that they're out there. The second model is a model that was introduced to us by Rav Soloveitchik. And I have to admit, this is one of the passages by Rav Soloveitchik that when I read it, it's very hard for me to get through it without tears. I've done it so many times, so you probably won't see me crying this morning, but it is a beautiful passage. He gave a eulogy for his daughter's mother-in-law who passed away, the Talmud Rebbetzin. Very interesting in the Jewish world, just a commercial break. Usually Hasidim don't get married to the Misnagdim. In this case, it happened. So, his daughter married a Hasidic Jew and became a Hasidic Rebbe. His mother died, and he gave a eulogy for her. And in this eulogy, he wanted to understand, what is the job of a Jewish mother? And his answer he gave was, I know what a job of a Jewish mother is, because I had a Jewish mother. And I'll tell you what her job is, because I had two parents, a father and a mother. And this is what he says. Father teaches the son the discipline of thought as well as the discipline of action. Father's tradition is an intellectual, moral one. What kind of Torah does the mother pass on? So if the father takes care of the discipline of action, namely teaching you that on Shabbat there's a certain way to make a cup of tea, and on the holidays there's a certain way to shake the lulav or to eat the matzah, that's what father teaches. What is the mother's job? Look on the sheet, please, and tell me what you think is the mother's job. We'll take a half a second. According to Rav Soloveitchik, what is the job of a Jewish mother? Yes, I think you have the answer. Your name? Sarah, yes. The soul. Says Rav Soloveitchik, the father can teach you how to keep Shabbat, but the mother teaches you what Shabbat is, what the atmosphere of Shabbat is, the soul of a Jew is. In his beautiful words, most of what I learned from my mother is that Judaism expresses itself not only in a formal compliance with the law, but also in a living experience. She taught me that there is a flavor, a scent, and a warmth to the mitzvot. And then he says a line that I just love. I learned from her the most important thing in life, to feel the presence of the Almighty and the gentle pressure of His hand resting upon my frail shoulders. Imagine how Rav Soloveitchik says, this is the most important thing in life, to feel the presence of the Almighty on my frail shoulders. So in a word, Rav Soloveitchik says, the father teaches you Jewish law and how to act like a Jew, the Jewish lifestyle. The mother teaches you the Jewish soul. What is a Shabbos supposed to feel like? In this article, and you can look it up online, he describes how he used to see his mother light the candles, the atmosphere she created in the home. It wasn't the law she taught, because that of his father taught. His father, by the way, was his exclusive teacher from the time he was 7 years old to the time he left home at 18. His mother taught him the soul of Judaism, the heart of Judaism. His father took care of his mind, his mother the heart. And without those two, if you listen to my lecture Thursday night, I don't think we have a future. So that's a second model, a very active model, not a woman that sends her sons and her husband to the shul to learn or whatever. She has an active role in giving the soul of Judaism over to her children. Yes.
Just out on a wing here, I'm a Jewish woman without children, and I would position that a woman teaches compassion. Because if you have law, you don't have to have children to still bring the soul of Judaism. into your community.
I think you're right.
If you have such a, I mean, I know in our synagogue, the rabbi keeps referring to compassion. If the woman doesn't teach forgiveness when we break the law, if the man is so centered on law and action, you must have a partner who can say, well, what do we do when that goes pear-shaped?
I think you're 100. Your name, please?
Ruth Miriam
says, and I think she's right, this is not limited to the home. This is limited to outside the home. In other words, a woman can bring into a synagogue the soul of Judaism, not necessarily the halachic discourses of Judaism. And I think you're absolutely right. And as he says here, without her teachings, which quite often were transmitted to me in silence, just by watching her on Shabbat, watching the experience of her mourning on Tisha B'Av, watching her daven on a holiday, I would have grown up as a soulless being, dry and insensitive. I am sure he'll keep all of Jewish law, but he would be, and I quote, a soulless being. So this is another model of a Jewish woman, Rav Soloveitchik's model, very active in the realm of the heart. The third model is a very active one in every realm, and that's the model of Devorah. How many people here heard of Devorah? Not your friend Devorah, Devorah of the Bible. Devorah was a shofetet, and as it says here in the source sheet on the right side, she judged Israel, and the children of Israel came up to her for judgment. Namely, she was a Jewish leader. She was a golden Meir of her time. This is not 20th century. This is biblical times. This is in the prophets, the second prophet, as a matter of fact. The book of prophets starts with the book of Yahushua. I think that's a beautiful name, by the way, and I'm being very, very objective. And the second book is Shoftim. And in the second book of the Bible, you will see this model. What do we sing on Friday night, right after Shalom Aleichem? Eshet Chayil. Eshet Chayil means a woman of valor. Did you ever look in the words of the woman of valor? Tell me, this woman of valor, she sits home all day and raises children and makes the meals and does the laundry. I quote from Eshet Chayil, you probably sang it Friday night. This is how Shlomo HaMelech, Shlomo Solomon, described the Jewish woman in Proverbs. I quote, she brings her food from afar. She goes out shopping. She contemplates a field and purchases it. She buys and sells real estate. She spreads out her hands to the poor man, meaning she has money to give to charity because she makes money for a living. And she stretches her hands out to the needy. She makes a cloak and sells it. She's in business. She makes the cloaks and sells it. She opens up her mouth with wisdom and instruction and kindness is on her tongue. She doesn't keep her mouth shut. She has what to say. Only what to say about politics. Only what to say about what's happening outside the Jewish world. Or also what to say about Jewish law. I'm pretty sure it's both. So the woman of valor that we sing every Friday night is a woman that's extremely active within the Jewish community and the general community. She buys and sells, she goes out to work. And these models all exist within our sources. And I can give proofs upon proofs to each model. But I gave you here a little sampling to try to convey, first and foremost, don't think for a moment that any of these models are better than the other. And don't think for a moment that one model is preferable over the other. They all exist within our sources. Long before the 21st century, there were women that went out to work, and there were women that stayed home and never worked, and there were women that only gave the Jewish soul and not the Jewish thought. It all existed. The question I have this morning is, which model do you find yourself in, or if there's a fourth and fifth and sixth model that I didn't bring on this page? And I'm pretty sure there is. Or perhaps we're a combination of all of these. We do encourage our children to go to school, and if a woman doesn't get up on time, we all know that the father can't manage. I mean, I've been around the world, and I know various times that a wife also has to travel just like a woman. A woman has to travel just like a man, excuse me. And I've heard many men kvetching to the second power about how they have to take care of their children when their wife is not around. Seldom have I heard women kvetching when it's the opposite. And at the same time, this woman works for a living. And at the same time, she gives the soul. Perhaps she's all three of these things. Perhaps she's only one. Perhaps she's only two. But they all exist. So I'm not telling you what to think. All I'm trying to tell you, first and foremost, is Don't let anyone tell you that they have the true Jewish classical halachic answer of what a woman should be doing, and if she's doing something else, it's apologetics. That's not true. If a woman goes out to work, Eshet Chayil will put her on a pedestal. And if she stays home and just encourages her children to go to school, the Gemara and Bruch will put her on a pedestal. And if she does both, then you have both Proverbs and Eshet Chayil, with Devorah being your model. So first and foremost, don't think for a moment that there's an objective criteria of what a woman should be doing. It doesn't exist. Once I've said that, let's go back to the question that was asked earlier by your name. Yael. Can a woman be a judge on a Jewish court? Can she be a rabbi? Can she be a religious leader? And we do have the model that we just quoted of who? Devorah. What is she called? Look in the source sheets. A shofetet, a judge. So obviously, if she was a judge, perhaps a woman can become a judge in a Jewish court. The bottom of the page, you'll see that the Gemara says that anyone that can't be a witness cannot be a judge. That's what the Gemara says in numerous places. A woman cannot be a witness in a Jewish court. That's a subject for another lecture. So, it seems pretty much of an open and shut case. A woman cannot be a judge. The problem is, anyone can guess? We just said it, yes? Devorah was a judge! So how can the Gemara say, whoever can't be a witness can't be a judge? There was a model of Devorah, who I'm sure wasn't a witness, and she was a judge. If you turn the page, it's three answers given by Tosfot, and each, I'm not going to say sect of Judaism, but I'd say each group in Judaism, whether you're for or against women having leadership roles, will choose one of these answers. The first answer on the right side of the page is, and I read in the Hebrew, the Shema lo hayta dana, ela hayta melamedet lahem dinim. Devorah was not a judge, because the Gemara says, if you can't be a witness, you can't be a judge. From our perspective, she wasn't a rabbi. What was she? Melamedet lahem hadinim. What does that mean? She was a Jewish teacher. She knew how to teach. She knew how to teach people how to make a cup of tea on Shabbos, what to do when a spoon that's dairy touches hot meat. And she taught people, not just women, but men, obviously, as well. Because as we saw in the verses earlier, all of Israel would go up to her. It doesn't say the women would go up to her. People would go up to a knowledgeable woman. And indeed, this is a very legitimate point of view, even though today people say, no, women can't decide Jewish law. This is one of the answers of Tosfot, that she wasn't a judge, but she could be a poseket. She could decide Jewish law. And how do I know this is true? Because the Sefer Achinuch says as follows. The Sefer Achinuch was one of the many books that wrote the 613 commandments, or what he thought was the 613 commandments. I don't know if you know this, but there's one controversy that doesn't exist in Jewish law. Everyone agrees to 613 biblical commandments. Isn't that amazing? There's no controversy on that. We love Machlokes. We love them. It's two different points of view. On that issue, nope, two points of view. A Gemara in the second Machlokes says 613 commandments. Now don't go home and say, okay, let's open up a whiskey. There's a controversy on what are the 613 biblical commandments. And there's many books published, Maimonides, the Bahag, and many others, what they thought were the 613 commandments. One of these books is the Sefer HaChinuch. And the Sefer HaChinuch says as follows. You're not, based on this week's parsha we read yesterday, you're not allowed to paskin halacha when you're drunk. Make sense to everyone? Obviously. And he says the following words. U'b'miniyato ra'av v'chol makom v'chol zman. Not to paskin halacha when you're drunk is bischarim, with male. And also with a woman that's smart enough and has the knowledge to paskin halacha. He doesn't say it's a feministic issue. He doesn't say. Simply, bit of medieval scholar comes and says it's with men and women. So obviously, he didn't think it was a problem. This is brought in the Shulchan Aruch by the Birkei Yosef and others, that a woman is allowed to paskin halacha. And there's various situations in the Mishnah where there was a controversy between a knowledgeable woman and a knowledgeable man. And we actually paskin the halacha like a knowledgeable woman and not like the knowledgeable man. Ruria is one of those examples. I can give you other examples. It's out there. So that's the first answer of Tosfot. And now you can well understand programs like that of Rabbi Riskin and others that just teach women how to paskin halacha and do not call them rabbis based on this answer. The middle answer of Tosfot says, Inami, Shema kiblu oto aleihem. Maybe in the case of Devorah, it was allowed, even though she can't be a witness, simply because of one reason. The Jewish people accepted Devorah upon them as a judge. Let's put it another way. The Jewish community voted to have a female rabbi. So it seems that the Tosfos is saying, indeed, this is something that is based on the fact that the community will decide if they want a rabbi or not. So in the time of Devorah, they wanted a woman to lead them. So perhaps today you could say the same thing. The Shulchan Aruch says, the Code of Jewish Law says at the beginning of the laws of slaughter, Hakol shruchatin v'chatchila afilo nashim, even women can go ahead and be a Jewish slaughterer. I don't know if she wants that job. I know I don't want that job, but she can. The Igrot Moshe, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein was asked, and I'm not going to read the whole tshuva here, but you can read it on your own if you understand rabbinic Hebrew. He was asked the following question. A man was a person who gave kashrut. He had a symbol of kashrut. What's the name of the symbol here? WK? KW? KW, right. So, a man was heading it, and he died. And his wife wanted to take it over. And all the rabbis, as we say in Yiddish, write Chai V'Kayam, no, a woman can't decide Jewish law. A woman can't be the mashkiach. A woman can't decide if it's kosher or not. And Rav Moshe Feinstein goes out and says, with due respect, yes, she can. If the community accepts her upon themselves, she can. And in it, I can tell you that I've known women that were mashkiach, kashrus, mashkichim, around the world. And there's many tshuvas that allow it, basically based on the fact of, if you accept it, it's okay. The third point of view is, absolutely forbidden, and in the case of Devorah, it's the exception to the rule, because God said she should be the judge. But other than God coming down and telling us, Mrs. Rabinowitz should be the rabbi, we can't have it. The Rambam is famous by saying that all the positions of leadership in Israel, from the king onwards, has to be filled by men, and the Ramah himself says that indeed you cannot give smicha to someone that can't do everything. So, we have these three points of view here. In between the three points of view on the bottom of the left column, I just want to represent to you a fourth point of view, which is sort of like the third, but a little different. Rav Herschel Schechter, who's a big rabbi, Rosh Yeshiva and Yeshiva University, the head of the OU Kashrut. He gives the Piskei Halacha, the decisions of Jewish law for the OU Kashrut. And he has a very interesting take on this issue. He basically says as follows. God is invisible. He's called a Kel Mistater. Sometimes he hides so well that many people don't know he exists. We have a name for such people. What do we call them? Atheists, right? We're supposed to be like God. We all have a divine image. We're supposed to walk in the ways of God. That's what we were taught as children, and that's a pasuk in the Chumash, v'halachta bidrachav, following the ways of God. So says Rav Schechter, a woman can do it fully, because she can hide from the public arena. She doesn't have to be a chazan in the shul. She doesn't have to get an aliyah. She doesn't have to say kaddish. She can hide from the public arena. A man, what can you do? Apologetically, he has to go to Minyan. So he has to compromise on his divine image in order to go to Minyan. He has to compromise even more on his divine image if they ask him to lead the services or to lay. So a woman has a perfect divine image, and a man has a divine image minus 2, 3, or 4. I don't know what you think about that point of view. I find that to be extremely problematic, to say the least. That's as if saying that every time a man goes to shul, feel bad about it. Because you're compromising your divine image. And if you're a chazan, feel even worse about it. Because you're compromising your divine image times 2. And if you're asked to lane, feel worse about it. But a woman should feel happy because she doesn't compromise any of this. Very unique point of view as I see it. I personally find it very, very, very problematic to understand, to comprehend. I don't feel that I'm going to shul in the morning by mistake. If the rabbi said, that's what you should do, I believe they meant it intentionally. But that's a point of view that's out there and you'll probably hear it. So to sum up, there's three points of view if a woman can be a leader, including in a Jewish court. One point of view is no, but she can definitely paskin halacha. The second point of view is yes, if the Jewish people accept it. And the third point of view is absolutely not. I don't want to tell you what to think. I just wanted to bring this to you to make you understand that when an Orthodox rabbi says, I am nominating a woman to be in the clergy of my synagogue, don't think that he's talking unorthodox. He's talking within our sources. He'll take the middle column and he'll make a living out of it. He'll take the middle column only and say, this is what we're doing. Our synagogue accepted it, so here I am. And if a rabbi comes out and says it's absolutely forbidden, he's taking the left column. And if a rabbi comes out and says, yes, a woman can paskin halacha, but not beyond that, he's taking the right column. So all these points of view are within the halachic system. They're not outside of it. They're not exterritorial. They're within the halachic system. Now comes the second question I presented before. So the first question is it forbidden by Jewish law? You saw the opinions. The question is not if it's forbidden or not allowed by Jewish law, but what's the second question? Do we want it? Now let's see a good example of do we want it. Turn the page. I hate to bother you, Aviva. Is there a way to put on the... Yeah, thank you. Do we want it? Now, I'm going to take one of the most famous cases in Jewish history of do we want it? And we're going to go with the case of not a woman rabbi, but a woman who was very smart, knowledgeable in Jewish law, and paskined a halacha, or gave a suggestion, I should say, in the halachic realm. If you look on the right side of the page, you'll see that there is two Toseftas. The Tosefta, as you know, was a Tanaic source that was not put into the Mishnah. And in these Tanaic sources, you could see, there was a question asked. Rav Chananya ben Targion said one thing. Ubito omeret. Anyone know what bito means? His daughter said like this. And finally, the Mishnah says, Yafe amra bito mi bino. The daughter was right, the son was wrong. Another Tosefta says exactly the same thing about Bruria. Here comes the famous case. It's called the Yom Tov candle case. This was like the case. Everyone talks about this case to this day. It's a beautiful case. What do you do Friday night? You light the Shabbos candles. Someone tell me, please, how do you light? You light the candles and you make the bracha. How do you light your Hanukkah candles? You make the bracha and you light the candles. How come we do the opposite? In all mitzvot, except for a few exceptions, we usually make the bracha and then we do it. We make the bracha, we shake the lulav. We make the bracha, we eat the matzah. We make the bracha, we light the candles. We make the bracha, we read the Megillah. How come with Shabbos candles we do the opposite? Because why? Right. There is a point of view of the Bahag, brought down by the Ramah, the code of Jewish law, that says that the minute you light the Shabbos candle, you make the bracha on the Shabbos candles, you've accepted Shabbos. For catch 22, you're supposed to light the candles in honor of Shabbos. So you make the bracha, and now you can't light the candles. Why? Because you already accepted Shabbos. Isn't that a funny one? By the way, the Shulchan Aruch doesn't agree. Rav Avadia Yosef instructed all Sephardi women to light the Shabbos candles like the Hanukkah candles. Same way. He said this whole Bahag thing doesn't make sense. What do you mean? She says a bracha. What does it mean to accepting Shabbos? How do you accept Shabbos? You say, I accept the Shabbos. Or you say, Lecha Dodi. Or you say, whatever. But you don't accept Shabbos with the bracha. But Ashkenazic women for generations have done it in the way that you've described. Your name again, I'm sorry? Talia. My wife's name. Easy to remember. Most of the time. You go ahead and you light the candles in such a way. And why do we do like this the three times and cover our eyes? to pretend that we didn't light. It's like a semi, I make the bracha, and oh look, the candles are lit. How'd that happen? That's what the Ashkenazic women have done for generations. I'm making fun of it, but that's the way Ashkenazic women do it, and that's the way we instruct women to do it. Fine. What about on the holiday, weekday holiday? This year, Pesach, seventh day of Pesach, will be Thursday night. When should you light the candles? Number two, how should you light the candles? Let's start with the second question. How? Yeah. On the holiday, are you allowed to light a flame? Yes. In which way? Transferring fire. Now listen to this. In the introduction of Rav Yosef Kohen, who was the son of the Drisha and the Prisha, two very important interpretations to one of the first codes of Jewish law called the Torah. You cannot get ordination without learning the Torah. He says the following. You may know the story, but it's beautiful. I brought you the whole story here from beginning to end. I won't read it inside, but he says, Ula atzor b'milin miyuchal. How can I even express in words? Ala sefer, on a book, ulisaper rov godel tiferet yakar, and talk about this wonderful, wonderful person who, Ma'alata Isha Hashuva Vahagvira, the wonderful, distinguished woman, and he goes on and on with adjectives, his mother, Marat Bela. Bela was his mother, married to the Prisha and the Drisha, and Bela said, I got a problem with the Jewish women. Friday night I understood your whole thing. But on the holidays you're allowed to light a candle, correct? So how come on the holidays the women light the candles like they do on Friday night? They should light it like the Hanukkah candles. Because you're allowed, even if you accept the Yom Tov by making the bracha, you can still light a candle on Yom Tov. You can light a candle to make a pot of pasta, and you can light a candle for Yom Tov. And the second issue she had is that how come the women don't light candles like they do on the eve of Shabbos before the holiday comes in? After all, not only do we light candles so we can enjoy a romantic dinner, we light candles in honor of Shabbat, and therefore we do it before Shabbat. So we should light candles in honor of Yom Tov, and we should do it before the Yom Tov starts. And indeed, was she accepted? Many, many have accepted her. First of all, the Jewish calendars accepted her. When do they put candle lighting time on for a weekday holiday? They don't say when the man comes home from shul, light the candles. What do they say? 18 minutes before sunset. So that part they accepted. The first part, many have accepted. And this was said by a woman. The Dago Mervava, the Sha'arei Tshuva, the Keter Shem Tov, and many others quote this woman and say she, Mrs. Bela, not Mrs. Bela, her first name was Bela. I don't know what her last name was. Bela is correct. The wife of the Prisha and Drisha was correct. And that's what we should instruct the women to do. Friday night, light, make the bracha, light, and then make the bracha. Holidays, just like Hanukkah, make the bracha and light. Number two, that number two was an interesting one. Many have accepted it. Light 18 minutes before. On the other hand, and this is like the biggest on the other hand I can think of, because you're about to hear one of the more offensive on the other hands, comes along the Magen Avraham on the left side of the page, the second source, and says, "B'yom tov tivarech v'achar kach tadlik, ken katav b'sof sefer adrisha b'shem imo." On Yontiv, you should first make the bracha and then light the candles. This is what was written in the Drisha in the name of his mother. Says the Magen Avraham, another important interpretation on the code of Jewish law. But women are not smart. And there's no difference between Shabbos and Yontiv. I think that's more in the more offensive Magen Avrahams. A woman's not smart enough to decide Jewish law. What are you doing changing Jewish law based on a woman's innovative thinking? We don't do that. If a man said it, we'll deal with it. But the Magen Avraham here doesn't say, is she right or is she wrong? She says right out, I am not even going to listen to what she said, because she's a woman. A woman is not part of the halachic discussion. And he's not alone. the Shari Tshuva quotes a very long tshuva about something that happened in the house with the chicken they didn't know. And he makes a big deal about the fact that the woman was the one that said the halacha, and he makes it clear, no, the woman gave the rabbi the reality, but she did not paskin the halacha. So as you could see, way back when, in the 17th and the 18th century, they were fighting out this issue of, can a woman decide Jewish law? So a woman said a very, in my opinion, logical halachic argument about Yom Tov versus Shabbos candles. And doesn't hurt, meaning it doesn't violate Jewish law. And many rabbis said, she's right. I don't care who said it, she's right. It makes sense. And other rabbis said, women are not part of the halachic discussion. And even more than that, we're going to say the opposite. And the Magen Avraham does say, light your Yom Tov candles like you do your Shabbos candles and don't make people crazy. I'm not kidding you, that's what he says. The lochil kul chachamim is another way of saying, when you start dividing and categorizing, you're making people nuts. Just tell them to do it one way and finished. Either allowed or not allowed. People think black and white and that's it. So as you can see, there is a Yom Tov case of candles where part of the Jewish community, deciders of Jewish law said, a woman is part of the halachic discussion as much as men. And others said, no way. Now where do we stand on this? As you can see, this morning, we first had to go into the question, does halacha allow it? And the second question was, do we want it? And as you can see, the Magen Avraham didn't want it. The Shari Tshuva didn't want it. On the other hand, there's a slew of others that did want it and said, yeah, why not? Good idea, put her at the table. And this issue is now germinating. It is being fought out in the Orthodox world everywhere. What is the place of a woman within the realm of the public arena of the Orthodox synagogue, which includes halachic paskening, which includes clergy, which includes leadership roles of sorts, shapes, and sizes? This is on the agenda. And I believe as Orthodox devout Jews, the first question always will begin with halacha. And the second question is, even if the halacha allows it, perhaps we're not comfortable with it. And I can give many other examples that I didn't put on the page, but I'm sure you heard of them before. Can women dance on Simchas Torah with the Sefer Torah just like men? I don't know what halachic argument you can make against it. The only thing you could say is we don't want it. And here's where I would like to make a statement that I think is very important. If you decide in your synagogues, we don't want this, but the women are demanding it, then you better come up with a different plan as to what women can do, because in my humble opinion, if you don't, we will lose them. So if you decide on Simchas Torah, women cannot dance, and definitely not with the Sefer Torah, even though again, I can't find the halachic argument to back that statement up, personally. But if you decide that, then the onus is upon you to find an alternative for women other than looking down from the women's section for hours and looking at men dancing. Because what do you think happens when women look down from the women's section on Simchas Torah and look at the men dancing? Let's start throwing out answers. Should I begin? First of all, you get bored. Second of all, a day called Simchas Torah, the happiness of the Torah, becomes the most boring, dreadful day for women. All they do is do this. Third, you think women have no mouth? They're going to sit in the women's section and just do like this? They're going to start talking. And when you start talking, you talk about many things. I'm not so sure that every woman is going to sit there and keep all the laws against slandering and against lashon hara while they're talking. I'm pretty sure the conversation will flow, and as it flows, we'll eventually get to my neighbor. And when it gets to my neighbor, I'm usually not going to say I have a wonderful neighbor. I'm probably going to say the opposite. Number four. Eventually, the men finish dancing and they go home, and they're all danced up. Maybe they had a whiskey or two. And they're in a good mood. We encourage women to go to synagogue, right? How do you think the women are going to come home that night? Angry, upset, mad. It's the time of our happiness. And we have made them very, 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 very sad. So, indeed you decide there's no place in my synagogue for such a thing, the woman is not on the clergy, she should not be part of the halachic discussion, then in my humble opinion, you have to find an alternative that is one that you will feel comfortable with, that will give women that same sense of spiritual fulfillment that they are in need of, because we in Judaism do not differentiate between getting close to God by men versus women. Everyone should feel a connection to Judaism and to God and to their synagogues. And if we encourage women to come to synagogue, and this is what happens, like I described on Simchas Torah, then we better come up with an alternative. And thank God synagogues have come up with alternatives on Simchas Torah for women. From dancing in a separate room, to the women having classes during the time of the hakafos, during the time of the dancing. And thank God, they've thought about it. But for many generations, and I remember this as a kid, I've seen women sit for hours upon hours upon hours saying, we hate this holiday. And I don't want women to hate Simchas Torah. I don't want women to hate anything about Judaism. And therefore, I think it's vital that if we say no, we find an alternative, a good alternative. Secondly, just before Raviva, bat mitzvah is also a very big issue. I personally cannot halachically justify a woman leaning from the Torah in a synagogue. I personally can't. I know that the partnership minions said they can. I personally disagree. Now, if that is the case, so a woman can't lean from the Torah, what bat mitzvah are we going to give her? And don't tell me at the end of the services we'll give her a present. Because if that's all her bat mitzvah is, a present, then it's a meaningless experience for her, while a boy spent an entire year trying to learn something. We have to come up with a good plan for bat mitzvahs, just like we do for bar mitzvahs. So the minute you say no, I think it's vital to also find the alternative. Aviva, please. That's what, in my opinion, should be our initiative. If you take anything from this lecture, it should be three things. Number one is if there's a request, it should be dealt with halachically. When I say halachically, I don't like the rabbis that go ahead and say, no, these are coming from the feminists, their motives are all no good, forget about them, I'm going to open a book. Done. I don't know what motives are, God knows what's in your heart. If a woman comes with an authentic request, I deal with it as seriously as I do when a man comes with an authentic request. If a man came to me and said, I'd like to play the guitar Friday night during Kabbalat Shabbat in the synagogue, I will deal with it in the same seriousness as a woman coming and saying, I'd like to lead a woman's prayer service. Just for women. Yeah, that's done in many places. That's done. They do what's called an early Shabbos. Before sunset, they play the guitar and they dance and all that, and then when sunset comes, they put the guitar aside. But I'm saying, I don't like the fact that we deal with women's issues sometimes on the question of motives, and when a man comes, we say, oh, his motives are pure, he's fine, so let's just deal with it halachically. First and foremost, halachically, correct Allowed, not allowed. If it's a done deal, not allowed, not allowed. What can you do? We surrender to the divine will. If it's allowed, the second question will be, do we want it in our synagogue? Is that the character we want to our synagogue? And number three is what I just added now. If we say no, if we say yes, it's allowed halachically, but no, we don't want it in our synagogue, then number three, what's the alternative? How do you allow those women to feel as close to God as a man? And here, one second please, Pnina. I just want to say that my motive in this issue is very clear. It's called Avodat Hashem, the worship of God. I want every man, woman, and child to feel they are in this world and they're worshiping God wherever they are. If it's in the office, if it's at home, they are servants of God and we are the representatives of God on earth. And I don't like the fact that many a times men are taught this and not women. So therefore, I believe that A, we have to see if halachically it's possible. B, even if it's possible, we have to ask our community, do we want it? And number three, if the answer is no, we don't want it, so what's the alternative? And I think that question has to be dealt with properly. And innovative ideas can come out that are even more beautiful than others. And I just give the bat mitzvah example. If we say no, and I say no, a woman cannot lane for men. That's my opinion. So the onus is upon me to find an alternative. So halacha says no, doesn't end there. So what can a woman do? And I've done many bat mitzvahs in my life, not one looked like the other. Every bar mitzvah looked the same, every bat mitzvah looked different, and I think it's beautiful that we can have different girls who are 12 express themselves in different ways when they get to that age of 12. Pnina. Right. I think you're right. By the way, I'll get to what you're saying in a moment. Just on that particular point of a woman giving a drasha in shul, if you go back to page, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, on the right side there's an Igrot Moshe, Rav Moshe Feinstein, before the English there on the left side, you could see that he dealt with the question of, can a woman give a lecture in shul? Not during davening. This is must be a beautiful community. Friday night, after they went home, they came back to shul to hear a lecture. And they wanted to know if a woman can give the lecture. Rav Moshe Feinstein, who I believe is someone that we breathe by in many different ways, said, well, only if it happens once in a while, and he says it shouldn't be done in the shul. Now, why not in the shul? The answer is exactly what Pnina said, the perception. And that was the second thing I mentioned before. Halachically correct, incorrect, it's probably fine. The second issue is, do we want it? Because one of the questions of do we want it is, how are we going to be perceived by the outer world? No one knows the intricacies of halacha. They're going to say, PHC is conservative. Why are they conservative? They're using a microphone. Go explain to them it's a kosher microphone. It's been signed on by every great rabbi in the world. No, microphone equals conservative. Finished. Now, I want to tell you that 30 years ago, if you did a bat mitzvah in a synagogue, they would say exactly the same thing. Bat mitzvah in synagogue equals conservative, liberal. Things take time to evolve, and therefore I call this lecture Opportunities, Evolutions, and Revolutions. I personally don't like revolutions because they're too fast. And I'll tell you why I don't like revolutions. One of the key things I enjoy dealing with in my life is to see returnees to Judaism, people that come back to their roots and conversions at times, where people really become Jewish from not being Jewish. The one thing I tell each one is do not do a major revolution overnight. Because the minute you climb the mountain to the peak too fast, you'll fall down very fast as well. It has to be a gradual process. So no, I'm not into the rabbis that say it should be a 3 or 4 year or 5 year process. I don't like that thinking. I never understood it for the life of me, but that's another story. Every person at their own pace, but there's a pace that's taken. You don't become a Talmudic scholar overnight. You don't become a doctor overnight. You don't become a lawyer overnight. And you don't become a devout Jew overnight. And the same, I believe, is true with regard to the issues we're dealing with. The issues we're dealing with are major issues. They take time to evolve. And I believe they're evolving. We started the lecture by talking about votes for women. And indeed, it took time till it evolved to the extent of today, the rabbis in Jerusalem tell every woman to go vote so that their party can get more seats. But in the beginning of the 20th century, Rav Kook, who I don't think anyone in this room would say was not a modern Orthodox religious Zionist, said, absolutely not. It will be the end of Judaism if women go to vote. Things take time to evolve. And I believe that's what I say at the end, that we need time to think about these issues properly, to think them through, to be thorough, and to think of the ramifications. I personally today believe that since we're living in a world in which women can do everything outside the synagogue, I don't want it to stop at the threshold of the synagogue where once you come into the synagogue, your job is at best to be a bystander in the women's section and at worst to watch the kids so they don't bother the men davening. If that's the extent of what a synagogue offers, I'm not so sure you're going to get many people to come through those doors. Correct me if I'm wrong, I don't find that to be so appeasing. Come in and look, or come in and watch the kids. I don't think many people like to watch the kids, and more importantly, I don't think they want to just be bystanders. And if you add in a third little cherry on top, oh, it's okay, you can put out the kiddish. If you don't get smacked in the face for that, then I'm pretty sure that many women won't come in for that. Therefore, I believe we have to come up with a way in which women feel fulfilled in the synagogue, in Jewish life. And if it's halachically okay, and we're comfortable with it, wonderful. But if it's halachically okay and we're uncomfortable with it, then I beg the question and I throw it out, so what's the alternative? What do you suggest in place of it? Because obviously there's a need, there's a quest, there's someone asking for it, and I don't think it's coming from the wrong places, but from the right motives, because I judge every person favorably, men as women. What's the alternative that you want? So basically, to sum up what I said this morning, many things are happening today in synagogues. Synagogues are changing. Aviva said earlier that in this synagogue, the Sefer Torah is brought into the women's section, and they kiss it. I don't find any halachic problem with it. As a matter of fact, even if I drank 5 cups of coffee this morning, I don't think my head would be able to come up with a halachic problem with it. But you should know that there's many synagogues out there that say, this makes me feel uncomfortable. Right? I know many women that are scared to touch the Torah. Because they never did. So obviously, when you never did and you're asked to do something, you're scared. Just like many men are scared to lift up the Torah. I don't know if you know this, but it's a very embarrassing thing if you lift up the Torah and it drops. Not only is it embarrassing, it could be everyone has to fast afterwards. It's embarrassing. So imagine that you go up to someone and say, can you do Hagva, which means to lift up the Torah. And this guy doesn't lift weights. This guy has no muscles in his hand. He can't do it. And he says, and he declines. It's an uncomfortable situation. Uncomfortable. So that gentleman who's a weakling, we're going to say, oh, you're a weakling, we give you nothing? Or we're going to say, oh, if you're a weakling, we won't give you Hagbah. We'll give you Glila, you have to wrap the Torah. In other words, I don't think that the fact that you say no to something, no, you can't lift the Torah because it's going to drop and we all have to fast, means that's where it ends. So if it's no, so what can you give him? And the same thing is true with women as well as with children. Children come to synagogues all the time, correct? What do we want them to do there? Enjoy. Get spiritual fulfillment, just like we want the adults. Now, if they go into the main sanctuary for a 2.5-hour service on Shabbos morning, in my humble opinion, If they get out of there without speaking one word, your child probably is deaf. He just can't talk. So they start making noise, and then the women and the men get annoyed, and they throw them out. And this is what they remember. All they remember from synagogue is the word shush. That's all they remember. Yes, what do you remember from synagogue? Shush. Shush and candy. That's it. So if we bring kids to shul because we believe it's important and vital, then I don't think we could sit back and say, well, we're going to run the shul, and the parents are responsible for their kids, and they should keep them quiet, and that's it. I'm going to go to sleep now. If we want to encourage children to come to shul, what are they going to do there? Is there children's services or isn't there children's services? So I'm always baffled by the fact that when it comes to children, we have never said, no, they can't come into synagogue, and that's where the conversation ended. We went on to say, so what's the alternative? Children's services. We even hire a youth director for that matter. But when it comes to women, it's no and take a hike. If it's no, then how do we incorporate them into the synagogue? If the answer is no and don't bother coming, that's an answer. But we don't say that. We say, here's a women's section, and we want you to be here, so what do we want you to do? So various things are being done today, and each one, you could see the comfort level. You mentioned the Sefer Torah. You mentioned the drush. You know how many synagogues fight over the right or not right of a woman saying drush in the synagogue? And again, I can't find a halakhic problem with it. If she's knowledgeable, and it's a good drusha, and everything is in place, I really can't find a problem with it. So I remember one rabbi telling me, no, 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 the women will come dressed immodestly. I said, if that's your problem, tell them to dress modestly. When you go to the Pope, you're dressed a certain way. When you see the Queen of England, you have to dress a certain way. I can't get over this. I have to tell you this. When one of my rabbis in the UK had to go meet the Queen of England for tea, apparently this is a very big honor in the UK. Anyone here from the UK? Is it a big honor? Linda, are you from the UK originally? I'm sorry. No. No? Okay. Mrs. Lawrence? No, only your husband? Only your husband. Okay. So apparently this is a big honor. And tea at 4 o'clock with the Queen. It was a big garden party. And they were all telling me about it. I didn't understand because I'm from America. I mean, if they invited me to tea with Obama, I won't say what I would say. Let's just say I once met a woman in England that said I once saw the Queen and just seeing her made me cry out of emotion. I said, trust me, if I saw Obama I would also cry, but it wouldn't be out of emotion. But ladies, when she went to the tea party, there was a dress code. A certain hat she had to wear. She couldn't just dress up any way she would like. There was a certain hat, there was a certain dress code for men as well as for women. So I told this rabbi, okay, they're not going to come modestly, tell them to dress modestly. That's your issue, done. No, it's still not done. I said, okay, it's not done. So what do you offer the woman? She wants to give a Dvar Torah. She's learned, she wants to express her learning. She has it in her. When something's inside, if you don't let it be expressed, it's like a balloon, it's going to pop. And when it pops, you don't want to be there. So what do you suggest as an alternative? And I think that's a very important question we have to ask ourselves. So if the drusha and shul is not going to come in because we're worried to change the services, so a drusha after shul, right after Adon Olam, or right before shul, or during the Kiddush, many examples and ideas can be put up, but we have to come up with these ideas, because if not, we're going to create a situation where the shul will be an exclusive club only for men, and I don't want to see that happen. I personally don't want to see that happen. I want to see the synagogue continue to be a place where both men, women, and children find their spiritual fulfillment. And this is an ongoing challenge we have to deal with. Firstly, is it halachically okay? Secondly, if it is, are we comfortable with it? And third, if we're not comfortable with it, then what do we suggest as an alternative? That's basically what I believe we have to do. Comments? Yes. No, not men. Not men. Men and women, the community. Oh, if I didn't make that point before, I want to make it very clear. When I say we, I mean your synagogue, which is a membership of both men and women, who the rabbi said, listen, halachically it's okay, so it's out of my jurisdiction, so to speak. You decide if you want this in your community. And the community gets together, and they vote, and they decide that they don't want it. Men and women. by the way, this does not go down the gender lines. No, men and women. So that's the case. I think the minute they both know, the next discussion has to be, okay, so what? Yes. What are we going to allow and see in our synagogues? I can't live with the no. Women ask for something. I think they're coming with a very beautiful Jewish quest. So much assimilation out there, and a woman wants to become part and parcel of the synagogue, and your answer is no? I can't live with that. I've seen too many people assimilate. So when I said before, we, I meant men and women, meaning the membership of the synagogue. Any other comments? I think that's very important. I thank you. I really believe that I am not going to be able to sleep at night if we found a way to make a substantial bar mitzvah for a boy and not a way to make a substantial bat mitzvah for a girl. Because girls and boys are part of the Jewish people. And they're both in the divine image, and they both are obligated in mitzvot, and they're both going to build Jewish homes, and I want them both to be inspired and influenced and warmed up by Judaism. And I want them to have a heart and a soul and a mind that thinks Judaism. So I can't live with the no. End of discussion. Let's go home. Time to take a nap. I think that when the minute we say no, we have to say, so what's the alternative? Now, sometimes the alternative is going to be one that perhaps won't allow every single woman in the synagogue to feel fulfilled. Perhaps. But at least we can go to sleep at night saying we've tried. We've done our best. We gave it our best shot. I'm hoping that we can maybe even do better as time goes on. But at this point, this is what we offer, and we think this is a good way to go, whatever it might be. And I want to say with regard to bat mitzvahs personally, there's a lot to do beyond reading the Torah. Today, I can even give you a secret. This is another lecture. Many a rabbi has written articles, and you can find it on the net, against the normative bar mitzvah we have in the synagogue. Because what happens is they're learning a parsha all year, that's all they're learning, and it becomes a very shallow experience where they know one parsha of the entire Torah. And that's it. And they usually never learn it again, and that's the whole bar mitzvah ceremony. And everyone throws candies, and everyone's very happy, but what have we given the poor kid? All he did was he went and broke his teeth over one parsha. So, I'm glad that's on the agenda again today. Yes?
I wanted to ask, in relation to bar mitzvah, to what extent do you think because if you observe what happens in Perth, not just in the synagogue, but overall, there are considerable effort and energy put into bar mitzvah program and that movement toward bar mitzvah within the school. And I wonder if we are not perhaps giving it as much thought within the synagogue as it might have been had the day school not kind of evolved as it has. It's interesting looking at this community and comparing what's available in the school and the thinking that's going into that compared to the amount of energy and effort we're putting in from our synagogues.
I don't know if you're going to like what you're about to hear.
Okay.
You know who I think should be in charge of the bar mitzvah experience of the boy and the girl? The parents. The parents. It's very nice if we say, and easy, the school will take care of it, the rabbi will take care of it, the Rebbetzin will take care of it. I think first and foremost, like anything else that has to do with your children, the parents. It's their responsibility. When my son was bar mitzvah 2 years ago, it was our responsibility. Now, how you channel that responsibility is a technical issue. A little bit the school dealt with, and that was wonderful. A little bit we dealt with, we, as parents, we learned together something towards his bar mitzvah. A little bit of bar mitzvah teacher dealt with. A little bit the day school, a little bit the synagogue. That's fine, but if you ask me seriously, who's in charge of the bar mitzvah of the child? First and foremost, the parents. Now how they go ahead and they, what's the word in English? Ha'atzalat samchuyot, 1 second. Delegate authority. How they delegate authority to others, that's fine, but at the end of the day, the responsibility, like all the education of our children, is upon the parents. I was smiling because in one of my trips to Liverpool, England, on Saturday night, there was an event with the students that was supposed to be for an hour. It went on for 2.5 hours, of which I would think a half an hour was food, and the rest of the time was an argument between me and a woman that is a devout Jewish woman. She keeps Shabbat, she covers her hair, and she puts on tallis and tefillin every day. And she taught her four daughters to do the same, and they do. And we had a big debate. And the debate was on the following issue, exactly what you're saying. She said that today, in the year 20, whatever it was, we have to encourage women to do every mitzvah, even if God exempted them from doing it. And I kept on saying the same mantra throughout. I said, I can't be more frum than God. God is the frumest. God is the most religious. I can't be more religious than God. So if God exempted a woman from sleeping in a sukkah, I cannot tell my daughter, you have to sleep in the sukkah, because that's making a mockery of the Torah. The Torah said, you don't have to. So when my daughter personally asks me on a Shabbos morning, do I have to go to shul? My answer to her is, there's a big opportunity for you to go to shul, but you don't have to. And you can, you will understand what she chooses to do. Sleeping late is a little more tempting than going to shul on a Shabbos morning. So there is once or twice a year where she has to go to shul. Megillah reading women are obligated to hear. Parshat Zachor before Purim she has to hear. But other than that, she doesn't go to shul. She's missing out on an opportunity? Yes. Does it kill her? No. Why? Because God said you don't have to. So if you ask me seriously, after we allow all these things, will it become obligatory? In my humble opinion, no. Because Judaism said that you don't have to. Having said that, if we believe strongly that without giving a girl a Jewish education today, Torah education on a high level, we won't have steadfast Jewish mothers and fathers for the next generation, Jewish homes will not be built. I'm not talking about a Jewish home where they light Shabbos candles, but a Jewish home that has a high spiritual level, then perhaps we would encourage it strongly. But I personally am not comfortable to be more religious than the Torah, to be more religious than God. So I cannot pass that hurdle. Where many women have passed and said, no, today we have to say it's an obligation. If they find the truth out later, their problem. But we're going to say it's an obligation until they go on to Google and find out not. And that leads me to my second point. There's no secrets today. Once upon a time, if a rabbi in the shul said, it's forbidden for a woman to touch the Sefer Torah, who's going to second guess him? Who's going to second guess him? No one. Today, the rabbi said, it's forbidden for a woman to touch a Sefer Torah. That moment, 25 of these get out of the pocket. Everybody, boom, Google, this search engine, that search engine. Rabbi, but he allows it, but he allows it, but he, it's not an issue. There's no secrets today. So I think that we can educate people to what there is, and we have to educate them to Torah, authentic Torah. And authentic Torah says women are exempt from time-bounded commandments, not all but many, and we have to educate women and tell them, you're indeed exempt. If you choose to do it, wonderful. I'll be very proud of you, but you don't have to. So when it comes to Sukkos, if my daughter would say I like my own lulav and etrog, I would shell out the money and buy it, and I'd be very proud. If I tell her on Sukkot morning, shake the lulav and etrog, and she says to me, but I'm not obligated. What's my answer? You're right. You're right. That's my answer. I cannot be more religious than the Torah. If a woman says to me on Rosh Hashanah morning, I'm not going to shul to hear the shofar, God exempted me from hearing the shofar, I cannot second guess that. That is true. If a woman says she does not want to say Kriyat Shema twice a day, even though I think it should be encouraged, I think it's wonderful, I think it's terrific, I cannot, as a rabbi, as a representative of God's Torah, come along and say to a woman, no, you really should. I would encourage it, I would say it's beautiful, it's lovely, but you don't have to. On the other hand, and this is important as well, we have to educate women as to what they are obligated to do. And many women don't know of all their obligations, of what they have to do. For example, do you know that every woman is obligated to say Kiddush on a Friday night? So if your husband's not home, or your boyfriend's not home, or your son over bar mitzvah's not home, you're obligated to say Kiddush on a Friday night. That's an open Gemara in Masechet Brachot, page 20. No dissenting opinion, by the way. So quite frankly, many women don't know that because they weren't educated. So when a husband's not home or a husband's called out to an emergency as a doctor, they don't make Kiddush. They're not doing a mitzvah they're obligated in. Women are obligated to daven at least once a day every day. You have to tell women that. Women are obligated to eat matzah on the Seder night. Many women think their job on the Seder night is to serve the Seder meal. They don't know that they're obligated in matzah and in the four cups of wine. And in many other mitzvot on the Seder night, we have to educate women and say, hey, this you're obligated in. It's not like this end all, you can do what you want. What you're exempt from, we have to educate. And what you're obligated in, we have to educate as well. And I think that's upon the rabbis and the school system. Here's where the day school does come in. Tell women what they're obligated in. Because many women are making mistakes out there today. Because we're not telling them what they're obligated in. And sometimes, and I'm going to say this very carefully, we don't educate women as much because we're worried about the issue of feminism and all that. But meanwhile, God's Torah, God said, women are obligated, and because of our, I would say, feminist phobia, we're not telling them what the Torah said to do. Yes, are there any other questions, comments? A little louder, please. If the shul is a boys' club, and that's the way you perceive it, then the question is begged. Why would I encourage you to come to the boys' club? And the answer is, we have to find a way to incorporate women. And there are ideas out there. I don't want to tell you that there aren't. For example, there is an idea, again controversial, but the idea is, let's forget about this idea of men and women davening in the same room. Take down the mechitza. Why do women have to daven in a minyan? They're not obligated to daven in a minyan, by the way. So, women come together in a room like this, let's say, and they'll have their own prayer group. They won't say anything that obligates a minyan. They won't say Kaddish, they won't say Kedusha, they won't say Baruch, they won't lay from the Torah, but they will have their own prayer group. In my humble opinion, if a woman gets up and takes like something like this, this lectern is a chazan, chazanit, I should say in Hebrew, proper Hebrew, and she leads services for women, perhaps that's the answer. Forget about the mechitza, forget about the normative shul. Others would say, no, this is the way we want it. We want women and men in the same room, the whole community davening together. That's fine, I understand it, I hear it, there's value to it, but if that's the case, how do we stop that feeling that you said it's a men's club? So, again, the minute you say no, you have to give the alternative. And I have various ideas in my head as to where the place of women will be during the services. I have various ideas in my head. Some of them I've already acted on, some of them I have not yet acted on. Because as I said earlier, I don't like the revolutions. I like the evolutions. And I believe they come. And when they come nice and slowly, they indeed are internalized and are a part of our community. Let's just recall that not so many years ago, women were not educated with a Torah education. At all. At all. The Beis Yaakov movement, which today is the ultra-Orthodox, was the first to educate women with Torah learning. Until then, every single rabbi quoted a famous Mishnah in the Sefet Sota that said, it's forbidden to teach your daughter Torah. I don't know one rabbi today, one, that would say that.
I think the idea of a men's club is also generational. Because our children are taught, our daughters, that it's not a men's club and they've got their role to see. I think everything, it comes down to change and evolution within religion, not the revolution. My mother would say men's club. After I was sat and had a heavy discussion on Asian Tile and took it away from being the very chauvinistic commentary to seeing the beauty in it, you change your mind. And I think our daughters have a totally different...
I think they do. I think they do. It's obviously a function of what's happening outside the synagogue. With regard to Eshet Chayil, I never understood how you can have a chauvinistic interpretation. Just read the words. I mean, according to Eshet Chayil, the woman does everything. The man's an income poop. The man does nothing. She works, she sells, she buys. The man's a nothing. He's a gornish. Friday night, you don't sing Ish Chayil, you sing Eshet Chayil. It's interesting. But I think that there's a lot of validity to that. But today we are in the Eshet Chayil model, and therefore it has ramifications on the way we run our communities. You can't live in the Middle Ages in your community, but outside the community, you live in the 21st century. It just doesn't work that way. So therefore, just to give you an illusion of what I said, there was once a synagogue that a new president came in and he said, you know, there's an old-fashioned bulletin board. And on the bulletin board, you put the times of davening and you put the flyers of all the events coming up. Instead of having a bulletin board, let's have a plasma screen. A nice, big, beautiful plasma screen, and it will change, and people can see it, and it's automatic, so there's no problem with Shabbos and all that, and it will shut off at night, go up in the morning, and this way, it's much easier. First of all, less trees are going to be cut down because you don't print flyers. Number two is, it's glossy, it looks very, very nice. What do you think the result was? What do you think the response was? Rabbi, you're going against tradition. The tradition is a bulletin board with the thumbtacks and the piece of paper in black and white. And how dare you go against tradition? Excuse me, a dumb issue, but it happens in synagogues. Synagogues bring out that traditional feeling of, this is the way we always did it, how dare you change it? I'll give you another example. There was a rabbi I know that comes to a synagogue and they tell him that your job is to say the announcements after services. Okay? So the rabbi gets there. The first 2 months, he's giving the announcements after the services. A good Shabbos, everyone. Evening services tonight is at 5 o'clock, followed by Shalos Siddur, sponsored by Mrs. and Mrs. Rabinovich in honor of their dog getting married. Then, Ma'ariv is going to be at this time. Tomorrow morning, Shachar, and this is he doing. After 2 months of doing it, he looks himself in the mirror and says, I don't understand. We have an internet site with all the times of davening. We have a bulletin board with all the times of davening. We have emails go out every Friday with all the times of davening. Why in God's name am I reading the times of davening in the shul every Friday? Every Shabbos morning. People can't get to the Kiddush on time. So he tells his synagogue, tells his president, there's no reason for these announcements. They're special announcements. First example, a special breakfast on a Sunday morning, that will announce. But the times of davening, they're all out there. President of the synagogue, rabbi, what are you, a reform rabbi? Changing? Tradition? Announcements is part of the service. He didn't see the announcements as announcements. He saw it as part of the service. So you have Shmoneh Esrei, you have the Torah reading, you have Adon Olam, you have announcements. And I'm not kidding you now. This is real, true stories. So again, when you come to synagogues, yes, that feeling is there. Tradition. We want to continue the way it was. We want to be a continuation. But I always said, as I said to the young people in this room Friday night, in my humble opinion, we always have to feel that we can look our predecessors in the eyes and yet add on our own link on the chain. And our link on the chain will be a bit different, but it will continue that tradition from all generations. So once upon a time, there was no plasma screen and there was no email, Facebook and whatnot. And you had to announce from the Bima, yes. Today we have to let people know when davening is. Albeit, we can do it in a different means. Much nicer, much easier, and people can get the Kiddush faster. By the way, the last one is usually the winner. If they can get the Kiddush faster, oh, for sure, we'll go with it. Yes, Yael? I believe that a bar mitzvah, as a bat mitzvah, is both a mother and a father's job to look after, and at that special moment, they both have to feel it's a special moment. Now, how do you do that practically is a very good question. I have a plane to catch, so I can't share with you about 5 ideas that I have on that issue. I will say that in every synagogue, I believe it should be on the agenda, and you should ask your local rabbi as to how he plans to include you in that particular ceremony in some way or another. And again, within the confines of Jewish law, we do have separation during the services of men and women, and that cannot be broken, and I don't want it to be broken, quite frankly. But how do we include women in the ceremony of a bar mitzvah? I can just give you one little tiny idea I had that I did in the past, and that was that before the bar mitzvah boy got called up for the Torah, I asked that both his mother and his father give him the blessing that's customary to give children on Friday night. So he went to his mother in the women's section, and the mother gave him a blessing. And then he went to his father, and his father gave him a blessing. And with both his parents behind him, he went up to the bima. And obviously I made a ceremony out of it and made it as much as I can beautiful in order for it to be meaningful. But there's many other ideas, and I think a local rabbi would be able to address that issue. Okay, everyone, thank you for listening. One thing I could say, women have much more patience than men. With pleasure, and I hope you do. And Aviva, of course, has my coordinates, my email, and whoever would like to continue the discussion, with pleasure.